okay. I'm just waiting for the system to come up, and it's operating. Good. A little, always when you're doing things live, you never quite know what to expect. So on with the topic. The main science topic for tonight is going to be the strangeness caused by the full moon. And that's something that I have an actual scientific explanation for this phenomenon. And if you ask any police officer, law enforcement officer, or bartender, or anybody else in general who works with the public, but those are the main groups where you see the really excessive, crazy behavior, people coming out of the woodworks. And this actually started a few nights before the full moon this past August 28th. About the 26th, I started getting reports of, well, just weird behavior. And I'll be talking about why that occurs during a full moon and why doesn't it occur during a new moon, because that is very much an electrical alignment also. We get a lot of heavy-duty weather right after the new moon. That's about 2 days after, typically. That's a trigger that triggers the a lot of severe earth weather. But it's the full moon that causes the human species to kind of go berserk, as they say. And that's an expression, a term that comes from people who are just acting crazy. At any rate, that will be the main science topic. And I think you're going to find some very interesting factors, some things that you never considered. But this August 28th full moon, 2007, was especially destructive or effective against, let's say, promoting strange behavior for a number of other reasons, and I'll get into those during the main science topic, second half of the show. First of all, I just want to do a little bit, I call this Economics 101, and in reviewing all of the information that I've seen over the past weeks regarding the stock market and the money being infused into the stock market by the Federal Reserve, there was a lot of misinformation and a lot of questions that were never asked and certainly never answered. So sometimes this show is not about economics, but when I see these topics being missed by the major news media and the other carriers that should, in fact, be discussing this, I'd like to include it on this show. And in fact, that forces them to cover it because they know that people are turning away from those main news media sources and turning to shows like this one to get real information. But at any rate, let's take a quick look at what the stock market was originally meant to do. You would invest in a corporation. You would say, I think this corporation is a good one. It's going to succeed. They've got good leadership. And you would put your money in that corporation by the way of buying stock. And then what the company would do is they would take that money. It didn't sit in a big bin in the basement of the company. That money was made to use to create investment, to build tooling, or whatever the company did to advance their bottom line, which of course is profit, and stability. So the whole point was that stocks were meant as an investment tool, and then the way you got your money back was over the long term you would then collect dividends, and as the corporation succeeded because you put your money into it, then you would get dividends back based on the profits of the company. And of course, IBM for decades was the mainstay of American business. Everybody viewed IBM as the calendar company, the poster company that would be the best you could invest in. And of course, if somebody had IBM stock, they were considered to be good as gold. But what happened over the years, a lot of strange behavior crept into the stock market. Things like short trading, selling short, speculation, buying futures, all of these things were never intended to be part of the stock market. And what they were based on was someone would make a profit because of a change. The stock price went up or it went down, and someone would be able to make a profit based on the change. So instead of long-term investment, you had daily profit based on change, and the stock market was never meant to do that. So the question comes, where did the money come from to pay the people who are daily pulling money out of the stock market because of rapid changes. So the idea was to have rapid change, not long-term stability. And that's where the stock market started to fail. The other thing that happened is corporations got a little bit greedy, you know, that great human trait. And what happened is as people started putting more and more money into their corporation, they would give themselves raises. The CEOs would collect huge, unruly salaries and bonuses and pensions and golden and platinum parachutes, etc. These were never meant to be. And all the money that would have gone back to dividends stopped going back into dividends. Enter the 401k, 1980, I'd say about 85, 86, wherever the 401k came in, where the common person who never owned stock in their life, they were now pooling money from your paycheck, a certain percentage, and then this money would be invested in a broad spectrum stock in portfolio. Well, what happened is it became clear that the money could be used to simply pay the top 3% dividend collectors, or the top stock owners of the corporation, typically the owners and a few people, a few quite wealthy people that could afford the majority of stock. But the thing about 401k is you couldn't get a dividend. You never got a dividend, and you were hedging on the fact that that corporation would still be around when you retired. And here's the other whammy that nobody quite understood. And I pointed this out when it very first started. I said, this is not a savings account. And people were calculating their 401k worth based on the total investment. Well, got news for you folks. That money ain't there. Neither is the corporate matching funds. So that magic number you have on a piece of paper is not like a bank account. And when you go to collect it, you're going to find out the rude reality that there is no money there. That money simply went through the corporation and on a monthly basis paid the dividends of the top 3% of the people that owned the highest amount of stock in that corporation that could collect dividends. So literally, the stock market is full of air, and now over the past month, people have started to wake up to that amazing little fact. And so they started pulling money out. The common man, this is not the big investor, but the common man started pulling money out. And thus the lack of confidence as, what a funny term, lack of confidence in the stock market. Enter the Fed, who started putting large amounts of money, if they call it that, into prop up. And the way the money was infused into the system was they actually gave the money to a few of their large corporate banks, the Morgans, the Chase, the banks like that, then received this money and could loan it out to prop up what they call the second-rate mortgage market. That would be the people who typically could not get a mortgage at a normal interest rate. There were so many foreclosures that the banks simply could not collect money anymore, and they were folding. So at any rate, when the Fed put money in, there are two questions that were never asked and, of course, never answered. Where does the Fed get the money, and who's going to pay it back? Well, first of all, the Fed doesn't have any more money than you or me. It's simply a number on a ledger. It's all phony money. And so when they gave it to their friends, what they gave was a debt that you, the taxpayer, would then have to pay back someday. So this magical infusion of money from the Fed was nothing more than an IOU that the taxpayer would have to pay the burden someday, with interest, of course. So at any rate, a little anecdote that I always like to include when talking about Economics 101 is that when I first learned about money and the fact that it was phony, had no real value, I said to myself, I always wanted to meet the man, the guy out there, who had so much money he could loan it to every country in the world, and every country in the world was indebted to this guy. So now this guy's got some serious cash. Well, it turns out that I did meet some of these people, and it turns out they don't have any more money than you or I. The whole money game, it's one of the biggest rackets ever invented by modern man. And it replaced a real money system that was designed to be, money was designed to be created by Congress as a national commodity based on value. And just an example, if you had a bridge you needed to have built, Congress would appropriate the money by creating the money. That would be backed by the bridge, which is value, and then the people who earned money by building the bridge would not pay taxes on that money, because why would they pay it back to the source where it originated? The whole design of money was part of the United States. There's a misnomer that capitalism and democracy go together. The whole point of money is that it's a value-based system. We no longer have a value-based system based on production or manufacturing or quality items, because all of that has been moved offshore. So we simply are left with a country with valueless money and a whole lot of debt. That's the end of lesson number one, Economics 101. And that's a good lesson for students who are starting back to school right now. So if you go into your economics class and tell that to the professor, he's going to look at you and not understand a word you said, because they're convinced that somehow there's real money out there. So at any rate, on to another, just a side topic, and this will be the last I talk about this, that businesses and large businesses and government entities, agencies, come into communities like your own, and the local governments are very easy prey. Let me put it that way. You find the mayors or the councilors or managers or whoever run your town, depending on the type of government structure you have, whether it's the county, the city, a township, the state, whatever. And these people are very easy prey for big business and government programs. And people like to always list all of the grants that they've given, that they've gotten for your local community, and they think that's a sign that they've done really well in office. But what they never list is how much money the community had to put with that, and then what are the strings attached to that so-called free money. All I'm saying is that most local governments, I would say, it's fair to say, are simply out of control of what's happening to them. They are entities where things happen to them, and they then are getting the public in their community deeper and deeper into debt and owing allegiance to corporations and other larger government entities. So that goes along with Economics 101. The end result of this, of course, in terms of the science world, is that science is owned and sponsored by government and special interests. But at any rate, on to the next topic. I want to do a quick review of August, the August predictions that I made, and I'm just going to do a quick review because all of this is over now. Not only did I predict exactly the day when all of the severe weather, earthquakes, volcanic activity, and tornadoes, electrical storms, hurricanes, and typhoons began, which was August 9th, that was a very accurate prediction, especially seeing that on August 8th, there was literally nothing of that sort going on. Not only did I predict the beginning, but I accurately predicted the end date also, which was August 18th. And so, without going into all the details, it is, once you understand what causes weather, you can understand how to start predicting, especially some of the major events. And what's very interesting about this entire prediction scenario is that the sun was extremely calm during this entire time. Now, typically, when we have planetary alignments, as we had in this August scenario from the 9th to the 18th, the sun is very much involved. You see the flaring on the sun, and those are kicking off the solar storms and the solar activity which we see, which drive our weather systems. This August was very different. The sun was calm as a kitten. So the weather, the severe weather we were seeing on Earth was actually a result of the electrical currents that pass through the solar system and the enhancement of those electrical currents because of the electrical alignment of the planets. Okay, so it's all fine and dandy to talk about that from a theoretical point of view, but you could also see this on the solar observation satellites, which are circling Earth and which are extended out to the sunward side of Earth. You could actually see all of these conditions as Venus moved into place. And now there's some very interesting conditions that are occurring the very last stage of this August series of alignments was the full moon with total lunar eclipse. That's where the Earth moves in front of the moon, in between the moon and the sun, and the light from the sun totally is blocked out. And the moon basically disappears and then it reappears in the course of about an hour. And this happened. Now, why would all of these factors affect the human psyche? And before I forget it, I just want to mention that about 2 days after the full moon, which is just about half a day ago, or actually last night, people were literally laughing, and this is all over. I saw people lightening up, taking just as if a burden had been lifted off their shoulders. I saw that people universally, whether it was getting gas at the gas station or going into the grocery store or just watching people in a public place, people were just very alleviated and very happy. But during the full moon, quite the opposite. The people were acting very strange, almost hostile. So at any rate, I'll be talking a little bit more about that. But that was the very end of this August series of electrical alignments. And oddly enough, Venus is one of the main players in this scenario in August, the full moon of August 28, 2007. So I'll be talking about that in just a minute. Now, last week I brought up the topic. Oops, I don't want to leave this topic out. It's the next one on my list. And if I skip things, then I tend not to go back to them. So at any rate, there's something I want to explain, especially to the shortwave audience. My books go into detail about this. I have a classification of scientists that I've developed. And this is to explain in kind of a very simple manner the way science works, and I call it tier 1, 2, 3, and 4 science. Now, if you've read my books, you're very familiar with this. There are a lot of people out there who possibly haven't read the books, or they're new to the shortwave audience, or to the internet audience. There's a lot of people who listen on the internet or listen to the archives later, and possibly are not familiar with this classification of science and scientists. So let me go through this for your benefit. Tier 1, 2, 3, and 4 science and scientists. Tier 1 is the group of scientists who you never see or hear about. They're the scientists who, in fact, are, let's say, with security clearances that are very high. They're doing science. They typically don't publish in journals. You may see them around universities, and sometimes they intermingle with the Tier 2 scientists. Now, let me explain. The Tier 2 scientists are typically what most people would consider our top echelon level of scientists. They work at the universities, they have NASA grants, they fly around, they are what we consider NASA scientists, the visible ones, and they typically promote some of the archaic, outdated theories like the Dirty Snowball Comet model, or the idea that all the planets formed at one time, or that there is no electrical activity in the solar system. that hurricanes are formed by warm water activity in the oceans, on and on and on. All of these completely incorrect theories are promoted by the Tier 2 scientists. Now, the Tier 1 scientists have a better clue on how things work, but they allow this incorrect Tier 2 science to be filtered down to the public, and the entire object is to keep the public as dumb as possible, as misguided as possible. And the reason for that is because if the public ever found out, for example, that there was free electricity just floating by us every day in outer space, so much that we can just tap into that using Tesla towers and using distributing it on our current grid system, electrical grid system, if the public found that out, they would probably tar and feather most of the scientists. So they have this rather mediocre grade of scientists who we consider, most people consider to be our top tier of scientists, and then you don't ever see the Tier 1 scientists. It's all smoke and mirrors. Now, the Tier 3 scientists are typically people that teach in, say, community or state college level, and they don't really do any research. We call them textbook repeaters. They simply can read a textbook and have the students regurgitate this material back to them. And these are the Tier 3 scientists. They probably get a minimal amount of contact with real research. And some of them might belong to organizations like NASA Outreach, where they fly around the country and talk to high school students and brag about how great NASA is. That would be the Tier 3 scientists. And then the Tier 4 scientists would be typically high school teachers that, once again, teach by a curriculum, teach from a textbook, and have an approved curricula that they teach from. Or they might be in some lower-level state positions. They might be in agencies of the government, and their job is to, say, monitor lake levels or hydrological conditions or count, you know, leaves on a tree. I don't know, whatever they do. So that would be, once again, Tier 4 scientists. The Tier 1 science, however, and I've seen and been around all of these levels of science, so I know how they work, and it's very amusing for me knowing who people are and as to see the Tier 1 scientists mingling with the Tier 2 scientists. And the Tier 2 scientists have no clue that that guy over there also has an entire different scientific life than these scientists know about. And I've watched young scientists, very good scientists, come up through the ranks, teaching at a university or getting NASA contracts, and all of a sudden they're plucked out and they're kind of put aside. And you see this happening. And they sometimes still will monitor meetings at American Geophysical Union conferences, etc. But you know that they also have a secret life, so to speak, in Tier 1. So I wanted to explain that. That's very important for people to understand exactly how these things work, to understand. And when you understand that, you understand what misinformation is. Where the newspapers get their information is typically from the Tier 2 or possibly Tier 3 scientists. And so that's the information that funnels down to you, the public, the incorrect reasons for storms or storm activity, the incorrect reasons for water not being there in Lake Superior, and that's actually the next topic. So that will weave back into my discussions every week after week. So just be aware of what the Tier 1, 2, 3, 4 science and scientists are all about. Now, last week I talked about Lake Superior, and of course this has been in the national news, that it's 2 feet down in lake level, and that's a lot of water. You're talking about Lake Superior, hundreds of feet deep, and I think it's about 1,100 feet deep at the deepest part, but it contains 20% of the world's liquid fresh water. If you took all of the liquid water, fresh water, that is, not the oceans with salt water, but all of the world's fresh water, there is about five times that amount of fresh water, that is non-saline, non-salt water, in the Greenland ice cap and Antarctica. Huge amounts of frozen water, and of course that's melting. But the fact that Lake Superior's water level is going down causes some suspicions. Where is it going? And I've seen all kinds of explanations, like, gee, there wasn't enough winter snowpack, or there wasn't enough spring rains. But see, the problem is there is an outlet to Lake Superior that's very well controlled. There's one outlet, and that is over at Sault Ste. Marie as it goes into Lake Michigan. But the point is, here's some of the disinformation stories that have been floating around the internet and in articles in newspapers, etc., that global warming is the cause, that magic term that is the source of all of our woes and is the biggest myth on the planet, but that global warming is causing Lake Superior to lose its water. Well, not really. I'm sorry, but I am quite familiar with that lake, and I suggest that anybody who thinks that Lake Superior is warm, just go jump in it someday, and I think you'll find that it's at around 44 degrees. Not exactly the temperature of water that's going to go evaporating away in the overnight. There was a report that the lake temperature was 72 degrees Fahrenheit. A world record for that lake. And I can tell you folks from personal experience, because I know the people who take the temperatures on a daily basis and catalog them, and I know from swimming in that lake myself, like I say, you go into that lake for a swim, you'll be back out in about 3.5 seconds at most, or you'll be dead because you'll freeze to death. Or you'll have what they call hypothermia, where that just draws the heat out of you so fast that, and the shock to your system is so severe that it would literally take your breath away. And the most comical explanation for the high temperature of Lake Superior that I've seen is that there's a volcano under Lake Superior, and that's where all the heat's coming from. Well, you take your own favorite reason why Lake Superior is low, and there's only one reason that makes sense. Somewhere that water is being siphoned off, and it's not exactly siphoned. I made a statement that on last week's show that I saw a pipeline, about a 3-foot diameter pipeline, being built through southwestern Minnesota in a place where there was nothing to pump. There was no oil, there was no natural gas, and it looked very much like a water pipeline. And I got input, oddly enough, from two more sources this past week that, in fact, these people saw the same pipeline going in, and the one sighting was much farther in southwestern Minnesota. So the point is, and these were being installed about 6 to 8 years ago, somewhere in that time frame. And the people that are reporting this also are reporting that when you go back to these locations, there's no visible sign of that pipeline. It was buried. And I know right where the one is, and the other person knows right where the other one is. And these are now documented. And we're going to go and take a look at these and see exactly what's flowing through that pipe. And I bet you, well, I wouldn't bet $1 million because I don't have it. And I'm not exactly a gambling man, but it's something that should be looked into. I did make calls to Senator's office because there was a blog that was on the internet, and it stated that there was a congressional debate and that the Lake Superior water was approved to be piped to Nevada. Now, I'm not saying this. I think this is a type of disinformation. If it's true, I have not been able to personally verify it by calling senators' offices. And these would be senators who would be very concerned being from Minnesota. So I have yet to hear anybody from these offices confirm that story. So one might ask, why is someone posting this on the internet? Well, the obvious reason is so somebody repeats it and tries to make it sound real, because then what they can do is pull out the white hats, what we call the white hats, and the people that come riding in to save the day and say, oh, that's just the stuff of conspiracy novels, and make it sound foolish. And so that's one of the disinformation techniques used, is to actually state what you know is true in the background, but which you then want to have disproven and made sound foolish. So at any rate, whether this is going on or not, I have not been able to confirm, but this is a subject of ongoing investigation, and I'll be reporting on this in weeks to come. But one thing is for certain, and that is water is a commodity, and it's going to be very tightly guarded. There's a lot of business activity now going into the control of fresh water. And as I've said in the past, now this past week, this past couple weeks, we've had tremendous flooding in various parts of the United States. Southeastern Minnesota had, and western Illinois had tremendous flooding. Also Wisconsin. These three states bordering the Mississippi River region of those states had tremendous flooding. People were out of electricity, a lot of people's houses literally washing away, but not a drop of that water has been salvaged. It all went down the Mississippi River and is all going to flow out to the ocean. We do not have a shortage of fresh water. We have a management problem. We have people in Congress, the White House, and other federal agencies who sit in their offices filling out forms and have no clue what they should be doing. We do not have a fresh water shortage problem. We have a fresh water management problem, and you'll find that that's exactly the same problem we have with the oil industry. There's no shortage of oil. We have an oil control and an oil refining control problem. That's why you're paying $3 a gallon for gasoline in the United States, and people in Venezuela are paying 16 cents a gallon, 4 cents a liter in Venezuela for gasoline. So at any rate, I'm just going to quick insert notice. Once again, the Big Berkey water filters, it's the one item besides my books, videos, DVDs, etc. that I sell, and that's because I think it's absolutely imperative that you have one of these in the world we are seeing today. What you draw out of your tap water cannot be trusted anymore. Cities are faking testing. We've seen all kinds of very bizarre behavior regarding water on the local level. And the bottom line is some people may say, well, I have an inline filter, but as soon as that water stops flowing, the pressure stops in your water system. If there's an emergency, your inline water filter system also stops, and it'll be absolutely worthless in an emergency. And so that's why I encourage people to get the Big Berkey. It's a 2.25 gallon container that sits on another 2.25 gallon container. You can put up to 4 Black Berkey filter elements in this and get dozens of gallons of water per day of fresh, clean water. This is the same unit that the Red Cross takes into an emergency areas. And so what I've put together is the best, what I call the best deal on the planet. You get the Big Berkey water filter, 2 Black Berkey water filter elements, and then 2 extra water filter elements. Then I throw in for free the Kato WRX 911 shortwave radio that I use when I go on trips. It's an excellent, very good shortwave receiver, and you can listen to this show on it. Then also free shipping to the 50 states. This is for $315. The manufacturer sets the price, and I offer those incentives. And so just quickly, it's $315. You can go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's jmcc, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, 7 letters. Or mail the money order or check $315 to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. I'll give that address again in a minute, but on to the topic of the day, the full moon, and why does it cause strange behavior in humans? Well, there are a lot of reasons, and I'm going to go through those, but let's first talk about the solar system, how it's built, and that will give us a clue as to why the full moon has an effect on human beings, on the psyche of humans, and after the full moon, why people are very relieved, as I said. But this year, August 28th in August, the August full moon has some very extenuating circumstances. One, it is a total lunar eclipse, and meaning that's perfectly aligned with the Earth and the Sun. And second of all, we have Venus out there. On the 18th of August, Venus was in perfect alignment with the Sun and Earth. Venus is between us and the Sun, and it has a long plasma tail, electrical plasma tail, which extends all the way out to Earth. As that moves aside, we are in the turbulence of that tail. In other words, it would be like a jet wing, and you are in the turbulent airflow off the backside of the jet wing. Well, that's the same condition we have with Venus and its plasma tail, and that it was occurring around, now remember, the 18th of August was the inferior conjunction of Venus. That's where Venus is directly aligned with Earth and the Sun. And around the 18th is when our severe weather started. Remember, on the opposite side of that, it was around the 9th of August when we first started catching that turbulence from Venus's, the Venusian plasma tail, that's when our severe weather started. That was one of the factors that caused severe weather. So on the flip side, on the opposite side of the 18th, on the 28th of August, when we had the full moon, we were once again in the other side of the wash, or turbulence, coming off the plasma tail of Venus. So now let's talk about what the full moon conditions are that cause the conditions that excite the human psyche to become bizarre or berserk, as they say. The solar wind coming off the sun is like a freight train of charged particles coming through space. During the new moon, that's when the moon becomes when the moon moves between the sun and Earth, the new moon is blocking the solar wind and also attaches to what is known as the sunward electron spike. That's a spike of electrons that is coming out of the sun at the same time. That's a very high energy spike. When the moon is behind us, that is during a full moon, then we have a very different situation. Now Earth is doing the blocking. The entire force of the solar wind is pounding down just a mere 30,000 miles out to our sunward side, and we get all of the vibrational harmonics off of the solar wind. Coming by, the Earth is out there all on its own, without any assistance from the moon to block that or assist in taking the blow. And the other thing is that electron beam, which can be very intense, is completely focused on Earth. And it's basically the vibrational frequencies. And then we have Venus swinging around. We're caught in the turbulent tail of Venus, and you could actually see this in the satellite data. This is the phenomenal part of this. This is not speculation. This is not just a concept that you can throw out or a theoretical idea. You could actually measure it in the satellite data. The magnetic field was flipping up and down like crazy, reversing, going positive, reversing, going positive, sometimes on an hourly basis. The intensity of the solar wind was changing very rapidly, and the direction of the solar wind. So you could see all of this fluctuation, very rapid fluctuation, in the satellite data, and these high-frequency harmonics are what causes the people to kind of get edgy. Let's put it that way. Now let's look at the people who this affects the most. If you are normally on edge or unstable, then this could very well push you over the edge. And you talk to law enforcement agents, if you talk to bartenders, those are the two groups that see the weird behavior the most, because then you start, say, in a bar scene, that's where the people are using substance, and which would enhance their so-called, well, what you might call deviant behavior. So, yep, bar, and then, of course, they go out and they get in their car and try and drive home, and then the police see them. And so you talk to any law enforcement agent, when they know a full moon is coming, they just go, oh, watch out, here's the full moon. They know very well that their jail is going to be full before the weekend is out. And I got reports myself from people who started telling me 2 days before the full moon that they were already starting to see the very strange behavior. And as I said earlier in the show, as the moon then moves out from behind the earth and starts picking up some of that activity, some of the solar wind starts to draw some of the attention away from earth, so to speak, of the solar activity, the solar wind, the wash, the turbulence that's coming off the tail of Venus. Once the moon starts picking some of that up, it's like everybody is relieved. It's just like a great burden has been taken off their shoulders. So there are real physical reasons why the full moon causes people to act weird, strange, bizarre, or berserk. Now, this brings up some very interesting historical anecdotes. When you read the Colburn, for example, now I haven't talked about the Colburn for quite a while, and I don't have my copy with me, but I have these passages somewhat memorized. And but they talk about the passage, which is pretty clearly the passage of a comet. They talk about the sky monsters and the screeching and the howling of the winds and the tremendous noise that occurred as these comets, the very large comets, would come through the solar system. And there are many instances in the Colburn when they talk about possibly two or three multiple comets coming through the solar system at one time, and the tremendous devastation that it exacted on Earth. We also see that in history they talk about Mars being alleviated of its atmosphere because a large comet came by, literally drawing off its oceans and atmosphere in a single night. So at any rate, the Earth has fared somewhat more positively in these past events, but the people who survived tell the tale, and it's very clear that during these passages of a large comet near Earth, that the shrilling noise, the electrical conditions were driving people crazy. And so it was far more intense than just the full moon, but it's the same type of conditions. And then the people survived this. They wrote down what happened and tried to pass this on to future generations. And if you read what the ancients talk about, it's very clear. It was caused by comets, not the little poofy comets like Halley's comets or the ones we see today, or even like Hale-Bopp, which was possibly a small to medium-sized comet. These were the big comets of old, the ones that snorted and ripped through the solar system, and the electrical effects, the severe weather, the hurricane force winds, the ones that flipped our poles from where they used to be about 30 degrees to where they are now. The North Polar Cap changed. It used to be what we call the Laurentian Ice Shield. It caused the tropical region, which is now in Siberia in Russia, which used to be much more tropical, caused that region to literally move up by about 30 degrees with the mantle and crust of the Earth sliding over the inner core, over that viscous layer of molten rock and volcanic ooze that is the somewhat the seam between the mantle, the crust in the mantle, and the inner core. So all of these effects taking place as a large comet came by, and very well documented in the ancient literature that people literally were, it is in fact amazing that anybody survived, but in fact they did all over the world. Small pockets of civilization did survive. Many of them were completely wiped out. But the point is that the electrical conditions of these passing comets and their effect on the human psyche, these effects are very well documented in the ancient literature. And so when we have a full moon today, we're just seeing a slight or very mild case of the same thing. So at any rate, that's part of it. So the effects, the overall number of effects, first of all, the total lunar eclipse means that the moon was literally right behind Earth, totally out of the solar wind. So Earth, in fact, was taking the full brunt of the solar wind, the electron beam that comes in from the sunward side, and the wash turbulence from Venus. Now, let me give you an example of a full moon that isn't that severe, when we also have strange behavior. Now, the moon can be in an orbit where it is about 6 degrees above the plane of the Earth or 6 degrees below. So, below the plane of the planets or the line that attaches Earth to the Sun. So, the moon can be fairly far away from alignment during those periods of time when when it's a full moon, but it's up higher in the sky or lower in the sky. And this confuses a lot of people because they think, how can the moon be so low on the horizon sometimes, and in other times it's so high off the horizon? It's almost straight up in the sky. And that's because you combine the 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth itself with the 6 degree tilt of the moon. And so you can get a tremendous variation in where the moon is positioned relative to the observer standing on Earth. So the same way with the full moon, there are times when it's very far out of alignment with the Earth and the Sun, even though it's a full moon, because it's lifted up off of the plane of the planets, of the Earth-Sun connecting line, or it's way down below. But on August 28, 2007, the full moon was directly behind Earth. So it was a total lunar eclipse. So that made August 28, 2007 a very special lunar eclipse. Then, as I said, we were in the month of August. Not all lunar eclipses or full moons occur in August. So we have the August return current sheet, which always enhances any electrical activity, no matter whether it's hurricanes or severe weather. It's always an enhancement because we have that electrical current that's just like a big plasma snake winding through the solar system, and we are right in the midst of that in the month of August. So we have the total lunar eclipse. We have the August return current sheet. We have the wash coming off of the trailing edge of Venus because it was just 9 days or 10 days after the inferior conjunction of Venus. All of these conditions were combined to make August 2008 a very unusual full moon. And so the activity, as I said, the report started coming in to me a good two days before the full moon. And then about 2 days after, as I said, it was very noticeable watching the people, just as if, you know, something severe had happened. And all of a sudden, 2 days later, like a big weight had been lifted off of everybody. Everybody was laughing and going around just shaking hands and friendly and talking with each other, whereas 2 days before they were like gritting their teeth. So these are the effects that these can have on the average person. And so are just very interesting. And this was such an unusual full moon that I decided to dedicate the Science Hour to talking about it, and that was a perfect lead-in to talking about the ancients, who had very severe conditions as the big comets came by through the solar system with very severe electrical effects. And as I said, when you read word for word, when you read what the ancients talked about and how severe the conditions were back then, you will realize that it's amazing that anybody lived through that at all. But they did, and we're all here. We're all living proof that those people survived some of the worst catastrophic conditions in the history of the world. And, of course, there were mass extinctions. This was during the time the mastodons and the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tiger and all of those related animals went under. They had been roaming this earth for a very long period of time. When you see very large animals like that, it took a very long time for them to develop to that size and the big herds. They require a very long-term stability to reach that level of development. And when the big catastrophe came through, it was the biggest animals who took the biggest hit. And you'll see that the people, the humans that came out of the other side of that disaster, were small, very lean, and very much survivors. So at any rate, I mean, they had to eat, they had to live on very little, and they made it through. And of course, as we progressed, you now find people, you know, big football players weigh 350, 380 pounds is not unusual anymore. Whereas even when I was young, you would not find that many people that size. So you can see how rapidly size increases with a population. And right now, in the United States, we are on the verge of probably moving up to almost 400 million people. And some people out there may say, well, we know that the population of the United States right now is around 300 million people. Well, I personally care to differ. There is very good evidence that we are about 100 million people more than the official census tells us. There's a couple more topics I want to get to here before the end of this show, because they came out and they're big in the news this week. One story, and I've gotten this feedback from a lot of people, they want to know what my opinion of this is, from the Associated Press. The title of this, it says, "A Whole Lot of Nothing Found by Astronomers," and whole is spelled H-O-L-E. And well, here's what happened. Astronomers were using various databases, including radio telescope data, and they've discovered what they believe to be a very large hole in space. In other words, an area where there's simply nothing there. And the quick and short answer to this is that the maps of the universe that we have today are based on redshift. That's the primary measuring stick used by astronomers in their databases to map out regions. So when a radio telescope goes out and locates, say, a cluster of galaxies or a certain large group of galaxies or whatever, then they go over to the data collected by astronomers with visible and infrared telescopes, and they look at the redshifts, and that's how they determine where this matter is in the universe with these objects, the galaxies or families of galaxies. But the redshift is not the real indicator of distance. And the reason is there is something I discovered back in my researches in the late 70s. There is a third source of redshift. It is called the induced electric dipole redshift. I'm not going to go into the details on this show, but it is due to internal conditions in the stars. And there's a good deal of data showing that, in fact, the redshifts that astronomers are using as their yardstick to determine the maps of the universe, that in fact those maps are totally wrong. And so there might be big gaps where they think there's a lot of material, and there might be a lot of material where they think there are big gaps. In other words, the location and distance to these objects in outer space is totally incorrect based on the interpretation that the redshift is telling you a distance. That's related to something called the Hubble constant. So at any rate, when you see that article, that's my particular interpretation of that. And I know I've seen this data many times. I've been around these groups, and they refuse to believe that that redshift, using the redshift as a yardstick, they refuse to believe that there's something wrong with that. So it would be like you were Columbus, or you were like one of the early navigators coming out and having a map, but all the distances were wrong. You knew there was an island over there, but the distance to it was totally incorrect. So map making has always been a very subtle business, and the map making distance scale that they're using, that astronomers are using today, is totally incorrect. At any rate, the other article that is being seen rather widely on the internet is regarding Saturn and the rings of Saturn. And of course, there's a great deal of research that's coming back from the Cassini mission that's been circling Saturn for quite some time. And I kind of had to chuckle when I saw this particular article. It's from space.com. I want to give the source of this. And they're talking about the rings, and oddly enough, it's a researcher at Cornell University, my old stomping ground, so to speak. So here we are in the year 2007, and they're talking about the rings being similar to the ring that formed the planets in our solar system. Very bizarre. We knew absolutely in 1979 that the rings could not be a permanent structure of Saturn, that they were variable and there was material coming into them, and that the material in the rings was leaving. So it was a very dynamic system, but they're still 2007, almost 30 years after I sat in that same research center and watched scientists still, you know, trying to claim that the rings of Saturn were left over from primordial material from the beginning of the solar system. They're still talking about that now. But here's the sentence that I really like. They're trying to talk about what causes variations, the extra heat that's coming off of Saturn. Saturn gives off much more energy than it receives from the Sun. So exactly where does that energy come from? And so they're talking about gravity waves and atmospheric oscillations, a tug of war between the planet's gravity and the buoyancy of the atmosphere. All of these bizarre explanations, but then here's what I wanted to get to. The last statement, it says, or Saturn's electric fields could be even more complex than before thought. excuse me for chuckling, but once again, it was very clear in 1979 that electricity was very influential in the workings of Saturn and its rings. And in fact, now the last statement I'll read also, just because it relates to electricity and their lack of understanding or lack of reading other people's material, let me put it that way, regarding Saturn. He says, this is once again talking about the standard science view of Saturn. It says, we don't even understand details of the electric fields on Earth, and those of Jupiter and Saturn are quite a bit farther away and different compositions. So at any rate, they're admitting that they simply do not know what's going on in Saturn. And I'm about out of time here, so I'm going to sign off. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.